reading Galatians 5, page 1172, starting to read at verse 1. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision that he is bound to keep the whole law. You are severed from Christ. You who will be justified by the law, you have fallen away from grace. For through the Spirit, by faith, we ourselves eagerly wait for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything, but only faith working through love. You are running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion is not from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. I have confidence in the Lord that you will take no other view than mine, and the one who is troubling you will bear the penalty, whoever he is. But if I, brothers, still preach circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? In that case, the offence of the cross has been removed. I wish those who unsettle you would emasculate themselves. For you who were called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word: you shall love your neighbour as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by one another.
Afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much, Helen, for doing our reading for us there. My name's Dave, for those of you who've not met me. And it's really good to have you here with us today, especially if it's your first time. If that is you, then, as Matt's already said, you're joining us partway through a series of talks. So let me just fill you in on what you're doing in case your conversations earlier didn't manage to do that. We're going through this letter from Paul, the early church leader and church planter, to the Galatians, so the churches that he planted in Galatia, which is part of modern-day Turkey. So he's writing to a specific group of people, and they're facing a specific problem, and we'll come back to that later. But in doing so, he touches, I think, on issues that we all face today, 2,000 years later, whether we're Christians or not Christians. The particular issue we're going to be thinking about today is freedom, which I think is a very culturally kind of interesting and important concept. Freedom is seen as one of our most fundamental human rights. Last year, Pete Jackson, who sat down the front here, and Matt and myself, we were in New York and we popped over to see the United Nations. And on the wall in one of the rooms there, they've got the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And freedom is all through that document. I looked it up on the internet today to refresh my memory. Right at the start, Article 1, it says this: all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Or Article 3, everyone has the right to life, liberty and security of person. Or Article 4, no one shall be held in slavery or servitude, and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all its forms. And it goes on to the right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion, that's Article 18, or the right to freedom of opinion and expression, that's Article 19. I think it's a really interesting document, the UN Declaration of Human Rights. Do get on the website if you want and have a read of it. But one thing that is very clear is that freedom is extremely important. You see it too in the fact that the heroes of the last century are guys like Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela, whose achievements for the cause of freedom have written their names indelibly on the history books. Freedom is cited as the goal for international actions on a world stage. So think back to a few years ago when the Iraq war was started. That was, we were told in part, about achieving freedom for the Iraqi people. Stories of freedom, releases, that kind of thing, can be incredibly inspiring. And actually some of the most depressing and tragic news stories are about people who are denied their freedom. And our art mirrors our life. So freedom is a central theme of many of our favourite films. For example, The Shawshank Redemption, that's probably my favourite film. It's usually the answer I give when people ask me. It's always high on people's lists, and it's all about freedom. The hope of freedom at the end of a long prison sentence. Or how about the unforgettable scenes at the end of Braveheart, when Mel Gibson, playing Scottish freedom fighter William Wallace, is being disemboweled by the tyrannical English king, Edward I. So, you know, Mel Gibson's stretched out on a rack or something. He's in epic, unbearable pain. And his torturers tell him that the pain will stop if he only cries out for mercy. But when he opens his mouth to speak, the scream is not for mercy. It's a passionate and defiant shout of freedom! I can't do it in a Scottish accent, sorry, but they're knocking Mel Gibson, so it's inspiring viewing, isn't it, for all Scots? I mean, just ask Matt here, I'm sure he loves that moment. Galatians chapter 5 verse 1, do turn back to it if you close your Bibles, is that sort of a cry. Okay, Paul isn't being disemboweled as he writes it, but it's the same sort of climactic declaration of freedom. It's Article 1 of the Declaration of Christian Rights, if you like. For freedom, he says, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. So he's spent most of the previous four chapters arguing this point. And then, as we saw last week, 2 weeks ago, he makes this conclusion. For freedom, Christ has set us free. So what's the point of Christianity? Well, amongst other things, it's freedom. Which is interesting, I think, because we don't always think of it like that. Every year at Christchurch Central, we have a recommended read for over the summer. And this year's book, which we advertised last week, is The Reason for God by Tim Keller. Here's one I read earlier. This is a brilliant book. I would say you've got to read it. Everyone in this room, it's really superb. It only costs £10 as well. That's for a hardback. So it's a total bargain. Anyway, in the first half of the book, Tim Keller is responding to a number of doubts or objections that people have about Christianity. And one of them is this idea that Christianity takes away from your freedom. So he has a chapter, chapter 3, called Christianity is a Straitjacket. It's a powerful image, isn't it, of the removal of freedom. And the chapter kicks off with a couple of quotes to illustrate his point from conversations that he's had with guys in New York. And I'm sure there'll be people here who can sort of, have had or still have this view of Christianity. So here's these quotes. Christians believe that they have the absolute truth that everyone else has to believe, or else, said Keith, a young artist living in Brooklyn. That attitude endangers everyone's freedom. Yes, agreed Chloe, another young artist. A one-truth-fits-all approach is just too confining. The Christians I know don't seem to have the freedom to think for themselves. I believe each individual must determine truth for him or herself. And it's not just young artists from New York City, is it? You see, from the outside, Christianity doesn't really look like freedom. I mean, Christians aren't free to get drunk. They aren't free to have sex before marriage. Their Sundays aren't free time because they have to go to church. They leave frisbee tournaments early to go and preach sermons. The list goes on. Christianity looks like it's just a big list of things that you aren't free to do. It looks like it takes away from your freedom. And you know what? From the inside, Christianity doesn't always feel like freedom either. So some people here will have turned up at 3 o'clock to set up the PA and the music equipment. Did that feel like freedom? Some people will have given up time during the week to prepare Bible studies or teaching for the children. Did that feel like freedom? Many of us will give up a free evening on Thursday to come to our monthly church prayer meeting. Will that feel like freedom? You'll have chosen to stop after your second glass of wine. Did that feel like freedom? You'll have slowed to 70 on the motorway. Did that feel like freedom? You'll have set your alarm half an hour earlier so you could get up and read your Bible. Did that feel like freedom? Or maybe you didn't do those things and you feel guilty because of it. Well, is that freedom? We have a problem, don't we? Because there seems to be a gap between Paul's declaration of Christian freedom in Galatians 5 verse 1 and our perception or our experience of what Christianity is all about. So what we're going to try and do over the next 20 minutes or so is kind of close the gap, really, and understand what Christian freedom really is. One of the most interesting and powerful examinations of freedom that I've come across comes in this book. A lot of books today. This is The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, probably the third greatest novel in the English language, and one that I had the privilege of studying at A-level. The book is basically about a future society in America where a fundamentalist religious and kind of hyper-Christian, interestingly, fundamentalist religious regime has taken over power and is denying people many of their civil liberties. And in defence of the regime, one of the characters says this. It's on the screen, and it's also in here somewhere. "There is more than one kind of freedom," said Aunt Lydia. "Freedom to, and freedom from. In the days of anarchy, it was freedom to. Now, you are being given freedom from. Don't underrate it." So it's freedom to, so freedom to do what you want, to go where you want, to spend your money how you want, or freedom from, freedom in the sense of protection from crime or from terrorism. And that same kind of either-or view of freedom is kicking around in society today. So just think of the debate about whether we should all carry personal ID cards. So the arguments are that on the one hand, well, it'll help society be free from crime and terrorism. But then on the other side, actually, do we really want that? Because it'll be at the expense of our freedom to go where we want and to do what we want without being watched the whole time. Freedom to or freedom from? Well, what we learn from this section of Galatians is that Christianity gives us both. It gives us freedom from, and it gives us freedom to. So far in the letter, Paul has mostly been talking about freedom from. And in this section we get a bit of a recap as to what Christians have been set free from and what the implications of that are. But Paul also starts talking about freedom to towards the end of the bit Helen read for us. So this passage kind of functions as a hinge between the two halves of the letter. And we're going to look at it in two sections. We're going to look at our freedom from, then we're going to look at our freedom to. Spend a little bit more time in freedom from, so if you get to the end of that bit, and we are more than halfway through, just to manage your expectations. So here's our freedom from, and what we're meant to do, or rather not do, with it. Christ sets us free from justification by works. So don't reject your freedom. Christ sets us free from justification by works, so don't reject your freedom. Look again at your Bibles and notice how verse 1 ends. Paul writes, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." What does Paul want these Galatian Christians to do with their newfound freedom? Well, he wants them to stand firm, to dig their heels in, to not let go of their freedom and submit again to a yoke of slavery, to go back to the thing that enslaved them, the thing that was like a burden to them, like a yoke placed on the backs of cattle. Those of you who've been here throughout our series in Galatians will know what that thing is, that burden. The Old Testament Jewish law, and specifically thinking that you could be justified by the law, that's the phrase used in verse 4. That identifies the issue at stake. Paul is talking about how you become justified. What does that word mean, justified? Well, being justified is being declared righteous, specifically in this case by God. Justification is God's legal declaration that you are righteous, acceptable, that you meet his standards and can have a relationship with him. And how you get justified has been Paul's theme for the last couple of chapters. So chapter 2 verse 16, it's coming on the screens I think, Paul sums up his argument. He says, "We know that a person is not justified by works of the law, but through faith in Jesus Christ." We sang it earlier, didn't we? "Because the sinless Saviour died, my sinful soul is counted free. For God, the just, is satisfied to look on him and pardon me." The problem for the Galatians was that some false teachers had come into their churches saying that faith in Jesus Christ was not enough. That believing in Jesus was all well and good, but if you really wanted to be acceptable to God, you had to kind of top that up by following every letter of Jewish law and custom, rituals, feast days, and even, as we see in this passage, circumcision. So look at chapter 5 verse 2. These guys, they've maybe bought into some of these feast days and festivals already, and now they're on the cusp of accepting circumcision as well. Let's be clear why this is such a big issue. Paul isn't against circumcision in and of itself. I mean, after all, he was a circumcised Jew, and he even had Titus, one of his co-workers, circumcised so he could work amongst Jews. So when he talks about the Galatians accepting circumcision, he's talking about more than just a medical procedure, because for these guys who weren't culturally Jewish, accepting circumcision would signify that they changed their beliefs and they were trying to be justified by observing the law. And that, Paul says, is slavery. He's been hammering home the point for a couple of chapters now, but here he summarises it in more passionate and extreme terms than ever. Just look how he begins in verse 2. Look, pay attention, mark my words, he's saying. I, Paul, yes, me, you know, the guy who started your churches and taught you the gospel and loved you and cared for you. I'm telling you really important stuff. And then he gives them three reasons why he's so strenuously opposed to justification by observing the law. Let's follow them through. Three reasons. Firstly, you lose the benefits of what Jesus has done. Verse 2, if you accept circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. So basically, when you depend on your own works, your own law-keeping, you reject the work of Christ. You see, Jesus lived the perfect life that the law demanded, and he died the death that we all deserve for our failure to keep the law. So the law is satisfied completely. Nothing else needs to be done. Somebody has kept the law, and somebody has paid the price for those who didn't keep it. So the law can't have any hold over you anymore. You've been set free. But if you accept circumcision, Paul is saying to these guys, well, you're rejecting that freedom and the benefits of what Christ has done. Let me give you an illustration of how stupid that is. This is quite a stupid illustration, but I'm over it. Pretty shortly, the new James Bond movie will be released, the bizarrely titled Quantum of Solace. Not sure what to expect from that. But I do know that we can expect that, as with all Bond films, it will be crammed full of spectacular stunts. Most of which, of course, will be performed by Daniel Craig's stuntman rather than the actor himself. So, imagine one day on set, they're filming this really spectacular and dangerous and difficult stunt where James Bond has to jump out of a plane at 10,000 feet without a parachute, and as he's falling, somehow he reaches into his back pocket and fashions a parachute out of the Union Jack that he always carries with him just in case of emergencies. This probably isn't in the film, by the way, so if you're going to go and see it, don't expect this scene. So he's got this parachute, Union Jack, and he manages to get it big enough to slow him down and guide himself safely in to land in the front seat of his Aston Martin next to the Bond girl. And the stuntman pulls it off in the first take. It's brilliant. But then, you know, he's a professional, so, you know, he's just doing what they're paying him for. So the director's got the shot he needs. The film is in the can. But then Daniel Craig turns to him and says, actually, do you know what? I quite fancy having a go at that myself. Do you think it'd be all right for me to give it a try? Can you imagine the response? I mean, the crew and the cast would think that he'd gone crazy. The stuntman has done it all. There's nothing left to do. Daniel Craig wants to go and needlessly repeat the whole trick. I mean, that's madness, isn't it? But that's what these Galatians were on the cusp of doing, rejecting Jesus' perfect work on their behalf and trying to justify themselves, trying to repeat what he'd already done. Here's the second reason why justification is madness. Justification by works is madness. You sign up to keeping the whole law. Look at verse 3. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision that he is obligated to keep the whole law. So you can't just keep some of the laws, Paul's saying. You can't pick and choose. You have to keep the whole thing. And of course, you'll never do it. That's why the law enslaves you. It's never satisfied. You can't meet God's perfect standards. We need to be realistic about this. We can't get away with thinking, as a lot of people do, that just keeping some of God's rules will be enough. That he'll just kind of lower the pass mark so that enough people can get into heaven. What kind of God would that make him? A God who's prepared to compromise moral standards? That's not really much of a God at all, is it? And here's the third reason. You sever your personal relationship with Jesus. By going for justification by works, as he says in verse 4, you are severed from Christ. You have fallen away from grace. And that would have been a real bombshell for these guys. I mean, they thought by doing all this Jewish stuff, they'd be pleasing Jesus. But in fact, the opposite is true. They're cutting themselves off from him. It may or may not be a pun on the process of circumcision, but however you look at it, being severed is something pretty final. Paul is keen to stress this point. If you opt for justification by works, you lose the benefits of Jesus, you sign up to keeping the whole law, and you sever your personal relationship with Jesus. So what's the opposite then? How do we get justified? Well, it's by grace, it's the word used in verse 4, by God's free gift of righteousness. The contrast between grace and works is total. We're going to look how it's described in verse 5, just take a little bit of time on that particular verse. We're going to work backwards through the verse, but it's worth taking some time over because it's really important to understanding this stuff, I think. So at the end of that verse, see that we have the hope of righteousness, which is a tricky little phrase to unpack. Here, first of all, is what it can't mean. It can't mean that we hope, in an uncertain kind of a way, that at some point in the future, God might choose to give us the righteousness of Jesus. I mean, where would be the assurance in that? God has already given us righteousness. That's been one of Paul's big points so far in Galatians. So here's what I think it does mean. I think he's talking about the hope that comes from righteousness. We have the righteousness of Christ, so we know that we are justified. We know that God looks at us and declares us righteous on the basis of what Jesus has done. And that gives us a great and a confident hope for the future. A hope that won't let us down. We can be sure of our place in heaven with God because we know we're acceptable to him because of what Jesus has done. And that, to me, is the sort of hope that's worth eagerly waiting for, isn't it? It's not like the sort of hope that you have when you're waiting for exam results to be published. You kind of have this mixture of hope on the one hand, but fear on the other, because you don't know whether you've passed or not. It's more like the hope of graduation from university when you know that you've already passed, you know you've made the grade. You're just waiting, perhaps eagerly, for the day when you get to wear a silly hat and get given a certificate. How do we take hold of this gift of grace? How do we do the eager waiting? We're back at the start of verse 5 now. It's through the Spirit, by faith. We just have to have faith. Faith, trust that Jesus has done it all. And that faith doesn't come naturally. It's something that God helps us with by his Spirit, which is a whole other big topic in itself, but one that thankfully we can save for next week for Matt to cover. See how Paul sums things up in verse 6. When it comes to how you're justified, how you're righteous by God, circumcision is meaningless. It doesn't matter whether you're circumcised or not. If you are circumcised, you can't boast about the fact. And if you're not circumcised, well, you can't boast about that either, as if non-circumcision is some kind of inverse good work. The only thing that counts is faith. But notice what he says about faith. It's not just faith. It's faith working through love. You see, there is an ethical dimension to the Christian life, but it's not how we get saved. It's the result of being saved. And we'll come back to that in a moment. You see, when it comes to our eternal salvation, faith and works are mutually exclusive. You can't combine them. This isn't the Pizza Hut all-you-can-eat buffet lunch, famously advertised with the slogan, "Can't decide? Have them all." It's either faith or works. You can't sit on the fence. So imagine a building where you're on the ground floor and God is on the top floor. How are you going to get to him? How are you going to get from you on the ground floor to God on the top floor? Most religions, I think, solve that problem by means of a staircase, a sequence of steps of things that you have to do in order to be acceptable to God. So you climb the staircase, when you're up there, you're acceptable to him, like the five pillars of Islam, something like that. And a lot of people think that's how Christianity works, that if you do X, Y, Z, you'll be acceptable. But that's not how Christianity works. It's not about what we do, it's about what God has done. So maybe you think of Christianity as more like an escalator. So God is kind of taking us up to his floor on the escalator. But when you're on an escalator, of course, you can run up the escalator to do some of the work yourself and get to the top a bit faster. Or you can just stand there. Or if you're particularly stupid, you can run down the escalator direction. So we sort of think on our little spiritual escalator, sure, well, okay, I'm acceptable to God because of Jesus. I'm on the escalator. But, I'll be even more acceptable, won't I? If I do a whole bunch of stuff, you know, if I live a good life, get involved with church, go on courses, learn Bible verses. Well, they're all good things to be doing. But they won't make you any more acceptable to God. We need to be careful, I think, of that kind of escalator view of Christianity, because it sounds appealing, doesn't it? I mean, God does a bit, and you know, there's a bit that we can do too to kind of pay him back or help him out. But no, says Paul, when it comes to our salvation, faith and works are mutually exclusive. Christianity is not like a staircase, and it's not like an escalator, it's like a lift. You step on board and the lift does all the work. Running around or jumping up and down in the lift won't get you there any faster. And isn't that incredibly liberating? We are free from having to earn God's favour. So don't reject your freedom. Don't think that anything you do as a Christian will act as any sort of top-up to your salvation. You are free, Paul says to the Galatians. But you aren't free to believe what you like and return to works. And you aren't free to believe who you like either. That's his theme in verses 7 to 12, which we're just going to cover quite quickly. I want to just sort of give a bird's eye view, I guess, of these verses. So hang on and enjoy the ride. You see, in these verses, Paul kind of shifts his focus from the teaching to the teachers. It's a really strongly worded warning to the Galatians not to listen to the false teachers who were telling them that they needed more than just Jesus dying in their place to be saved. And it's very strongly worded. Verse 12 is an extremely cutting remark, isn't it? I mean, he's pretty much saying that, you know, with all this circumcision going on, he hopes the knife slips. But that just shows how strongly he feels about this stuff. He's really passionate. These guys understand and stick to the truth and listen to the right people. So, look at verse 7. The Galatians were off to a good start. They were running well. But now they've been hindered. They've been kind of elbowed off course. And in verse 8, he wants them to consider the origin of the false teachers. They aren't from him who calls you, that's shorthand for God. Don't listen to them, he's saying, because they're not from God. In verse 9, he moves to the effect of the false teachers. Their teaching will spread like wildfire. It's a metaphor from baking, a metaphor Jesus himself used in Mark 8, saying that just as a little leaven, that's like yeast, makes a whole lump of dough rise, a little false teaching sprinkled in can corrupt an entire church. So don't listen to these false teachers, because their teaching is dangerously infectious. And then in verse 10, after reassuring them that he thinks that they will come through it and they will side with the truth, he talks about the ultimate destination of the false teachers. They will bear the penalty. Don't listen to them, he says, because ultimately they are headed for judgment. Verse 11, still with me? Verse 11, he deals with the message of the false teachers. Look at the end of the verse and see what they're doing. They have removed the offence of the cross. Paul even counters some accusations that were flying around that he himself was preaching circumcision. But he says he can't be, because if he was, he wouldn't be under such persecution. Why is he being persecuted? Why is the cross so offensive? Well, let me give you three reasons. Firstly, the cross tells me that I was so bad that Jesus had to die for me. It's a powerful demonstration, isn't it, of how far short of God's standards I fall. And that is offensive to my pride, because I like to think I'm better than that. I like to think, you know, surely Jesus didn't need to die for me. Secondly, the cross tells me that I'm saved by a humiliated, weak, dying man. And that's offensive because my pride doesn't want to submit to someone so apparently weak. In some ways, Jesus isn't a very impressive saviour figure at all, humanly speaking. Especially to, you know, Jews who are expecting some kind of all-conquering Messiah to sweep in and kick the Romans out and set up a Jewish superstate. And thirdly, the cross tells me that because the job is done and the penalty is paid, there is nothing I can contribute to my salvation. And that's another offence to my pride. Because, well, I want to be able to do something to be saved. I want to be on the escalator. I want to be able to top up faith with works to pay God back so I feel like I've earned my salvation. But that's just not how the gospel works. Don't listen to these false teachers, says Paul, because their message isn't centred on the cross of Christ. And we do well, I think, to follow these warnings ourselves to make sure that we're listening to people whose message is centred on Jesus, who aren't watering down the gospel to avoid persecution. But we must press on. We are free from justification by works, and we mustn't reject our freedom. So Christianity isn't if you do, then you'll be. It's not if you do X, Y, Z, then you'll be acceptable. It's the other way around. It's if you be, that's terrible grammar, but I'm sticking with it. If you be, then you'll do. We need to get our being and our doing the right way round. Because there is doing in the Christian life. Of course there is. We are free from justification by works. And we mustn't reject that freedom. But there's freedom too to consider as well. So, much more briefly, Christ sets us free to do the work of love. So don't abuse your freedom. Christ sets us free to do the work of love. So don't abuse your freedom, verses 13 to 15. Let me just read those verses again to refresh your memory. For you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love, serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbour as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by one another. My dad's here today, so I thought it'd be a good idea to slip in a quote from the Rolling Stones into my talk. Now the Rolling Stones have got a song called I'm Free, which contains the line, I'm free to do what I want any old time. It's a great line, but Christian freedom is not Rolling Stones freedom. It isn't freedom to do what you want any old time. It's almost as if Paul is anticipating that kind of a response. You know, you can hear the readers saying, so if I'm free from having to live in a certain way to be acceptable to God, well, can I just do what I like? No, says Paul. Don't abuse your freedom. It isn't an opportunity for the flesh, which is a funny kind of a phrase. But what he basically means is that Christian freedom isn't freedom to follow your selfish and your sinful desires. That's not what you are set free for. Instead, Christian freedom is freedom to serve one another through love. It links back to that phrase, faith working through love, that we saw in verse 6 earlier. So that means that Christian freedom means service. You could even say that Christian freedom is a form of slavery. Slavery to one another. That's quite extreme, isn't it? But this sort of slavery isn't a burden, like slavery to law keeping. It's actually incredibly liberating because it's motivated by love. Love, you see, is in many ways, I think, the ultimate freedom. So to quote Tim Keller again in The Reason for God, the Great White Book, as I've dubbed it, he says this, is in his chapter on Christianity as a Straitjacket. Human beings are most free and alive in relationships of love. We only become ourselves in love, and yet, healthy love relationships involve mutual, unselfish service, a mutual loss of independence. So love, the ultimate freedom, is more constraining than you might think. Which means, doesn't it, that we kind of need to rethink our concept of freedom. Freedom is more complicated, more complex than we think. True freedom isn't the absence of rules. It's not, you know, having no rules whatsoever. That would be anarchy. It's finding the right rules. Here's Tim Keller again. Freedom, then, is not the absence of limitations and constraints, but it is finding the right ones, those that fit our nature and liberate us. So freedom means putting the fish in the ocean, not on the dry land. On the one hand, the ocean constrains the fish, doesn't it? I mean, he can't leave the ocean or he'll die. But, you know, does that mean that he isn't free? Would you ever say of a fish swimming around in the ocean that they aren't free? Well, of course not. Actually, it's only in the ocean that he is truly free, because he's in his element. He's in the place that best fits his nature. Just watch Finding Nemo if you want to understand that. Another great film about freedom. You see, freedom means finding the right rules. And the right rule is love. Look at verse 14. Paul sums up the law as being about loving your neighbour. So he's not letting law kind of in through the back door as the way to be saved. But he is pointing out that in God's law, God always wanted us to love each other. Even the law was designed to show that. We just couldn't do it because, you know, we, people, we wanted to use the law to prove our own worth to God. And if you're always trying to prove your own worth, then you can't love your neighbour as yourself, can you? Because you're always trying to be better than them. That's why that approach will lead to the behaviour of verse 15, biting and devouring and consuming. That's why churches that operate on the basis of law keeping or moral observance will always in the end be really kind of divided and competitive and really rather bitchy. I mean, maybe some of you have even been in churches that are like that. But the great thing about the gospel is that our freedom from means that we can do our freedom to. So if I'm free from having to prove my worth to God or to others, free from having to look like a good person or like a good Christian, so that I feel like a good person or like a good Christian, or so that I'm acknowledged by others as a good person or a good Christian, if I'm free from all that, I can actually get on with just loving people for their sake rather than mine. I think that's incredibly attractive, to be serving people and loving people, not out of pride or out of duty, but just because you love them and want the best for them. To be serving people out of an exercise of your Christian freedom. It's attractive, but it's also incredibly challenging. Because that kind of love, that love that is the ultimate freedom, is constraining. It does mean giving up your time and your energy. It means giving up your emotional resources, your material resources. It means a lot of commitment. But that didn't stop Jesus, did it, from acting in that kind of love, from freely giving up heaven itself to suffer the constraints of humanity, of human injustice and of death, to set us free. And if you believe that stuff, then you are free. For freedom, Christ has set us free. So don't reject your freedom by returning to justification by works, whether that's explicitly by thinking of religion as a staircase, or sort of more subtly by thinking of it as an elevator. And don't abuse your freedom. Don't abuse your freedom by failing to love one another. That is the freedom that we were saved for. Stand firm in it. Dig your heels in. Tell yourself the gospel every day, every hour, every time you're doing something that feels like a constraint. Some of those things that I listed at the start are things that make us think that actually Christianity isn't freedom. Let's remember that we are set free for freedom. Remember how Jesus has fulfilled the law by serving us through love. And remember how liberating that is. Think about what our church would look like if we had more of that loving service of one another. Think of what our society would look like. It would be pretty amazing. And it would show the world how great our God is and how powerful his gospel is to set us free.